You have your Bibles. I want you to turn to Luke chapter 17. Sort of piggybacking off of the idea of today being Mother's Day. Sort of an inverse sermon we're going to be looking at in Luke 17 with Mother's Day. And we remembered our moms and our grandmothers on Mother's Day. We want to talk a little bit about, as we look at the context of Luke 17, a woman that we do not want to remember. Or we want to remember in a different kind of way, as Jesus would say. But in Luke 17, he says in verse 22, and he said to the disciples, the days will come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say to you, look there, look here, do not go away, do not go after it. For just as the lightning, when it flashes out of one part of the sky, shines to the other part of the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And just as it happened in the days of Noah, so it shall also be in the days of the Son of Man. And he's going to give the parallels here that are very, very similar. In verse 27, they were eating like today. They were drinking just like today. They were marrying like today. They were being given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. That gives another correlation here. He says in verse 28, he says, it was the same as happened in the days of Lot. They were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planning, they were building. And we also know they were sinning. Verse 29, but on that day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. So here's the admonition. Since the parallels are the same, this is what I need you to do, disciples. Jesus is basically kind of summing up for them, okay? Learn some things from Noah. Learn some things from Lot, okay? Because he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And this is what's going to take place. It's going to be Christians in Jerusalem. And so you need to know, if you're going to escape the destruction that's coming upon that city, you need to understand it's going to be an awful lot like Noah and Lot. So this is what I need you to do. This is where Lot's wife comes in, which is the keynote for our sermon this morning. He says, verse 30, and it will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let not the one who is on the housetop and whose goods are in the house go down to take them away. That's interesting. So if I'm at one part of the house, and all of a sudden I realize what's taking place, I'm not supposed to go and do certain things to make my escape. Okay? Sounds like a sense of urgency. That's what you do when there's a fire in the house or there's an explosion. You just get away from it as fast as you can. He says, and likewise, let not the one who is in the field turn back. And when he says turn back, that launches the second shortest verse in the Bible. Shortest verse is Jesus wept. This has got to be the second one because there's three words. Remember Lot's wife. Now, they would have connected the dots here. Oh, that's right. She turned back. And so he uses her as a negative example for a positive outcome. You do not want to be caught in that moment trying to gather up things and lock the door or whatever else you're going to do. You need to beeline it away from Jerusalem. This is the context of the destruction of Jerusalem in Luke 17. And he goes and says in verse 34, whoever seeks to keep his life shall lose it. And this is the context. If you seek to try to tarry, to linger, you'll lose it. And whoever loses his life shall preserve it. You're really going to lose your life. In other words, let it go. The things of this earth go straight. You'll preserve it. I tell you, on that night, there will be two men in one bed. One will be taken and the other will be left. There will be two women grinding at the same place. One will be taken and the other will be left. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other will be left. And when he says that, the disciples kind of say, taken left, taken left, taken left. In other words, there's this great separation taking place. And notice the separation takes place on the turn of a dime. You got two men sleeping. You got two people in the field. I mean, they're doing natural courses of their existence. They're not in some refugee camp and one's taken and one's left. They're not as if they're on in you know, the midst of waiting on a mountaintop, waiting for Christ to come back, and one's taken and one's left. They're in the midst of the pursuits of everyday living, one's taken and one's left. And then the disciples ask in verse 37, where, Lord? Basically, where are they taken? And the short answer what Jesus is going to give, not the longer answer, but I'll give you the short interpretation. He says, and he said to them, where the body is, there also will the vultures be gathered. You've seen that? Roadkill, and there's vultures on the side of the road with the roadkill. So he's, when they ask him, they're saying, taken where? And basically he's saying, taken to destruction. Because that's what you have with the symbolism of taken and then vultures and things of this sort. So you got to understand something. One will be taken away in destruction. One will be left to survive and persevere. I always thought taken meant in the rapture. When we take it up in the rapture, the other guy's going to be here for the 7-year tribulation. But in this context, he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And if you know anything about the historical destruction of Jerusalem back then, you can read the accounts of Josephus, that the disciples, the people who were living in Jerusalem, had maybe a 3-day window to get out of the city. That's it. Titus had surrounded the city, because that's what he says in, I think it's chapter 17, no, I think it's 21. Yeah, when he says in chapter 21, verse 20, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. He says, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city. These are days of vengeance. In other words, when you see the city surrounded by the armies, here's where you want to have your TV set on. You see them surrounded by the armies. You go, wow, you mean the entire Roman army has surrounded Jerusalem? Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Jesus said, that we need to flee the city. And what happened is that when Titus surrounded the army and he was going to lay siege to it, word came that there were, I think, Parthenians or whatever that were over there by the Euphrates, and Titus withdrew his army to go confront that army over there, thinking there was an army coming up on his flank, and he left the city until he found out there was no army over there, and then he came back and surrounded the city. So that little window frame was the time when they saw that city surrounded initially by Titus, and then Titus withdrew, because you couldn't leave if Titus had surrounded the city. Then they left, and the Christians left and went to the little city of Pella as a result, and they were spared. And then when Titus came back and surrounded the city, he never left and destroyed the city. Not only that, it's in the city. You can read about Masada and things of this sort in the last stand of the Jews and things of that sort. But this little, that's the historical backdrop. But Jesus brings up Lot's wife. And why does he bring up Lot's wife? Remember Lot's wife. Because she's the perfect example of someone fleeing destruction. Like they're going to be fleeing the city that's going to be destroyed. And it didn't profit her. She turns into a pillar of salt. Now, that's the basic thing we want to remember about Lot's wife. If you remember that about Lot's wife, basically, as he says, that, as he says, I think it's in Luke 9, where you put your hand to the plow, you don't look back. Once you put your hands to the plow, you're going forward. The oxen are pulling you forward. And if you turn back, you're going to mess up the road. I mean, there's just no point in turning back, looking back, any of those things. You've got to be focused and you've got to be resolute to go forward. We also see, and this is a classic case in Hebrews chapter 2, I'll just read the verse to you, where the writer of Hebrews makes the statement in chapter 2, verse 2, because you're going to see when we get back, when we go to Genesis chapter 19, the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 2, verse 2, he says, for if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable. Now, what in the world does that mean? The word spoken through angels. Because the angels in Genesis 19 are going to speak a word to Lot and Lot's wife. And it proved unalterable. Let's take a look a little bit at this as we go and we dive a little bit deeper into this idea remembering Lot's wife. So we want to remember Lot's wife in the general context of Luke 17, which is, we're not remembering Lot's wife like we're raising a memorial to Lot's wife. We want to remember Lot's wife and not be that guy, as we use that little phrase. She's a negative example in the Bible. It's funny, Lot's wife is never named. We know Abraham's wife, but we don't know the name of Lot's wife. Well, why is that? Because you don't need to know her name. You just need to know her actions. And you need to know that what she did, you don't want to do. Now, Genesis 19 is going to get into the meat and potatoes, so to say, of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But before that, before we remember Lot's wife, we need to remember a little bit about Lot, because you won't understand the woman unless you understand the man. It's Lot's wife. And so the reference there is to Lot before it's to Lot's wife. Who is Lot? Now, if you go back in Genesis chapter 12, when Abraham gets called out of the land of Ur, if you remember, he goes forward. And it says his, basically his father. It says in chapter 11, verse 31, and Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran. Now, so this is, Abraham is an uncle to Lot. Lot's a nephew, okay? And they take them all, and it says in chapter 12, they go out from Ur. It says in verse 4, so Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him. Abram, the Lord spoke to Abram. Didn't speak to Terah, didn't speak to Lot, didn't speak to anybody. He spoke to Abraham. And he wasn't Abraham yet. He was Abram. When God cuts the covenant, you put your name with the other person. Another person puts their name with you. That's where God's reference is friend of Abraham, because he takes that as part of his title. But then Abraham takes part of God's name as his title. He's not Abram anymore. He's Abraham. Abraham. So he changes his name as relationship and covenant with God. But we see what takes place here. It's not so much baggage as Abraham's just leaving by himself. I mean, he takes Sarah. He takes his tents. He takes his livestock, takes his slaves. He takes all his possessions with him. And he's got his nephew with him. I mean, he's got even his, I think his father, because his father goes as far as Haran, and then he dies. But we see this man Lot going with his uncle. And we know in 2 Peter chapter 2, Lot is not just a hanger-on. He's a righteous man. We're told that. Told three times that he's a righteous man. And the evidence that he's a righteous man in 2 Peter chapter 2 is because he walked an aisle, or joined a church, or he gave really great Christmas gifts to Abraham, or something like this. It's because of the testimony that when he was in Sodom, he wasn't with the Sodomites. It said that his soul was tormented, like day and night, because of the unrighteous deeds of the unprincipled men around him. And what you understand with the whole idea of Abraham being called, you just read this in Hebrews chapter 11. I'm just trying to give you the cliff notes. When God calls Abraham, the most telling thing about the call, okay, there's two things about the call. There's a leaving Ur, and there's separation from the world. And there's their joining into a land that God's going to give. Abraham has to sojourn in the land that God is going to give. And so Abraham, being the father of the faithful, resembles us an awful lot. And we resemble him. He's the father of the faithful, so to say. We're a chip off the old block of the faith of Abraham. When God calls you, he calls you out of quote unquote Ur. He calls you out of the world. There has got to be a separation from the world. That doesn't mean you go live on an island in the Indian Ocean. It just means that I do not think like these people anymore. I do not have these principles like these people anymore in this culture. I am separate from them. Even though I might be like wheat and tares growing in the same field, I am not like that guy. I am not like that nation. That's not me. There's a separation. But then there's also a sojourning in the land. There's an enjoying of the inheritance God gives you. And you sojourn. You don't go in there and build a castle of a moat and everything. You sojourn in the land. We explore, as it says in Ephesians chapter 3, the height and the depth and the width and the breadth of the love of Christ. Your entire life, and from going forward, from the day you're regenerated and you're converted, is to explore and have your eyes dazzled at the awesomeness of Jesus Christ and how much he loves you. That's your Christian life. You're exploring all the ways he loves you. So many times, like we used to phrase it, you're drugged through a knothole backwards sometimes through trials. But all of that's designed in Romans 8 for you to experience the great love of Jesus Christ. but it's never going to happen living in self. You're going to have to be separated from Ur. And so he separates. God calls him out of Ur. And Lot goes with him. So Lot's in the separation business like Abraham's in the separation business. Well, if you kind of read a little bit further on, it says in verse chapter 13, so Abraham went up from Egypt to the Negev. Now, I got to tell you this. We don't know when Lot gets married to his wife. Because we never told in chapter 12 that it says, you know, Abram went forth from Ur with Sarah and Lot with his wife. Never says anything like that. It just says Lot with his nephew, was his nephew. And it's interesting in verse 5 of chapter 13 of Genesis. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. There's a great time to talk about his wife going with him. Doesn't say anything about that. But we do understand that as Abram begins to sojourn and goes and leaves, and they all have property, that all of a sudden there comes strife between Abram and Lot in verse 7. And really it's more with the property and the people and these herdsmen. It says there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. And basically what happens is Abram goes to Lot and says, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. It's not the whole land before you. Now notice what Abram does. He goes, please separate from me. Separation. There's that word again. Please separate from me. If I go to the left, you go to the right. If I go to the right, you go to the left. In other words, you call the shot. We're not going to flip a coin. I'm going to let you make the call. Here's where we start beginning to get introduced into not Lot's wife, but Lot. And let me tell you why that's important, because Lot's wife is going to learn from Lot. The reason why she becomes a negative example is because Lot's not up at full speed when it comes understanding the separation principle and this exploring the land principle. We know he's righteous from 2 Peter 2, but we have to almost be told that he's righteous because his testimony and his witness is pretty dismal as we begin to see what takes place in his life. So what happens? What does it say here? And it says, verse 10, you're the man who walking by sight, isn't it? And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. Why is that important for Lot that you have this valley of the Jordan that's well watered? He's got livestock. He's thinking of his business. He's got his business hat on. He's thinking of money. He's thinking of keeping his business afloat. I need land that's going to be well watered that can take care of livestock. He's walking by sight. His priority is my livestock first. He's not thinking like Abraham. It says in Hebrews 11 that he has a city that doesn't have foundations down here or well-watered lands down here for my livestock. And you see that because Abraham gives him the choice. You can make the call. Abraham could say, I'm your uncle. Back off, buddy. God's called me to this land, so I'm going to choose where I'm going to go. You're just going to fend for yourself. I didn't do that. Abraham's not walking by sight. And so he gives Lot that call. And what happens? It says, this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. It makes that point. Like the garden of the Lord. This is some lush ground. This is where you want cattle. This is where you want your business to flourish right here. Like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot, verse 11, chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Verse 12, Abram settled in the land of Canaan, which is where he was called, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and noticed and moved his tents as far as Sodom. The writer tells us Moses he's moved his tents as far as Sodom. He's getting closer to where he doesn't need to be. Now, I don't know if he's got his wife with him yet or not. We don't know where his wife came from. You read in the histories of all this, you read Talmud, you can read Spurgeon's sermons, I read on different places. Some believe that she came from Egypt. When Abram went down to Egypt and all this and had problems and even got Sarah and all this, had problems with Lot. Whether Lot learned from his uncle these things or he met his wife when he was in Sodom. We don't know. We're not told anything about Lot's wife in chapter 13. We just know now that he's moved his tents as far as Sodom. And we're reminded again, verse 13, the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. Now, this probably, that's why you have the next verse, verse 14, when God appears to Abram after Lot had separated from him and then talks about his descendants and how they're going to be as, you know, numerous of sand on the sea and things of this sort. It's easy for Abram at this point to begin to wonder or need some confidence, who's my heir going to be? Because technically it could have been Lot. That's a nephew. And you could have given your possessions and your heir could have gone through Lot. Because remember, Abram and Sarah had no children. And so here's this ace in the hole, Lot, that's kind of sojourning with him. And then finally it gets to a point God providentially puts the herdsmen against each other where Abram says, no, we can't keep this up. Look, we're going to do something here. And so when he separates, he begins to realize, there goes my heir. And God does that because he's going to do it again with Hagar. There goes my heir. He's going to shut down all these human efforts to make an heir when God's going to say, nope, it's going to come from me. And it's going to come by grace. And it's going to be Isaac. But that's later on down the road. Right now, all of a sudden, when Lot separates from him, you see God confirming the promise again to Abram. There's a reason for that. Because probably in the back of Abram's mind, it's like, all hope is lost. There goes my heir that I thought God was going to be using, you know, to bring Lot up. And, you know, there would, you know, we'd have children through Lot, that kind of thing. It ain't going to happen. So what happens? We get into chapter 14. Lot's over there. He's moved his tents as far as Sodom. Chapter 14, Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain get overrun by an army. As it says in Chedorlaomer. It says in verse 12 of chapter 14. They took Lot, Abram's nephew. Abram gets up his army, his guys, and they go and they rescue Lot. Verse 16. They get back all the possessions that was stolen by this king, Lot with his possessions, and also the women and the people. Well, no, got women here. Didn't say anything about his wife. But they're all back in the quote, good graces of thankful to Abram. Good old Abram helped us out and brought us back to our city. Why, he's a swell guy. And you're going to find in chapter 19, when the angels go down to Sodom, where do they find Lot? They don't find him in his house. They find him in the gates of the city. Why is that important? Because when you're in the gates of the city, you're someone important. That means you're a judge in the city. Judges are found in the gates of the city. You got any kind of business dealings or financial transactions like Boaz did to acquire Ruth, you go to the gates of the city. And that's where the elders are of the city. And that's where the transactions take place. And they're at the gates because people come from outside the city and people come from inside the city. It makes a perfect spot right there at the gates of the city. And so this whole idea that him being rescued by his uncle, you could understand the what's called maybe the nepotism of this, where they're all looking and saying, man, who's that guy? Well, that's Lot's uncle. He's the one who did all this. Really? That's your uncle? Oh, man. Congratulations. You know, and you can see how he could have a rise to a position of prominence in the city of Sodom because they're very thankful to his uncle. Well, by the time we get to chapter 19, well, chapter really 18, if you remember in chapter 18, you have Abram or Abraham is wrestling with the three that have come to Abraham. And they say, should we hide from Abraham what we're going to do? Of course we can. We're going to tell him. We're going to go down there. We're going to see for ourselves what's in that city, and we're going to destroy the city of the plains. Well, Abraham knows where Lot lives. And that's why he starts offering this prayer in chapter 18 about, surely you wouldn't destroy the entire city if 50 righteous are in the city, right? Verse 26 of chapter 18. And then kind of barters down, you know, 40, 30, 35, all the way down, 20. And then he says in verse 32 of chapter 18, then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. And as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed, and Abraham returned to his place. And then the big melodramatic scene of chapter 19 of the destruction of Sodom. And we realize what happens is, Abraham is working off the conclusion that God's not going to destroy that city if there's 10 righteous people down there. Abraham might have a hunch that it might be one. He knows his nephew. Now, technically, historically speaking, the time that has passed between all of this is about 20 years. So you can imagine moving his tents closer and then finally getting into the city and then getting captured and being brought back. 20 years, he could have easily found a wife in the city limits of Sodom. When we get to chapter 19, it says, now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. See, this is where he's at. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. That's great reverence and respect to these men. And he said, now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house to spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way. They said, however, no, but we shall spend the night in the square. Interesting. That's not the reception on, that's not the return of the hospitality that the angels gave Abraham. They stayed with Abraham. They let him do those things. The angels were not going to do that with them. They were going to stay in the open square. But what happens? Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. So, okay, we'll do that. And he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. I have to think Lot's wife did this. She not said, doesn't say she did this, but he has a household. We know he's got two daughters. We're going to find that out later on. All these people are in the household. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. Jeez, nothing like a little bit, you know, direct to the point, huh? But Lot went out to them at the doorway, shut the door behind them, and said, please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. My brothers. Now, remember, this guy's living in Sodom. I don't know if he's the mayor of Sodom, because he's living there in the gates there. But he tries to reason with these people. Now, behold, this is interesting. Pay attention to what he says, and then draw the connection to his spiritual condition. This is a man who lives by sight, thought of his business. He moves his business closer. He starts living in Sodom. Probably picked up a Sodomite woman. Didn't mean she was a Sodomite. I mean she was a lesbian. It just means that, you know, if she was from Sodom or he brought her there from Egypt or whatever, Canaan. But whatever it was, we know Abraham was not going to allow his son to marry any Canaanite or Egyptian woman. Remember when his servant, he told his servant to go find a wife for my son. You go back to my relatives over there because we're separate from these people. Abraham knew that. He knew that from the get-go. Lot would have known that from the get-go because Lot initially dwelt in the tents of Abram before he became Abraham. We're not to have any traffic. We're to sojourn among these people. We're not to have that type of social intercourse with them that we adopt and develop all of their principles and their mindset and do the things that they think is right in their own eyes, and that becomes what we do. We don't do that. But what happens, I mean, he's got this camaraderie with them, calls them brothers, and he says in verse 8, now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with men, with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like, only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof. Now, as gross and unbelievably unloving that is to your own daughters, there is a thought that maybe these are his, not biological daughters, and might have come with the property of Lot's wife, like stepdaughter. We don't know. Have no clue. But they're his daughters, legally his daughters. And he's willing to barter them off to get these people away from his door. There's a real, that's the guy you want to hold up as, you know, father of the year when it comes to, you know, selling off your daughters like this for the sake of holding at bay these people from every quarter of the city coming in wanting to have homosexual relations with these two angels. And this guy is in the gates of this city. Now, you would tend to think anybody with that kind of mindset would have said, I'm getting my family. I'm leaving. We're not going to stay here anymore. I made an unwise decision 20 years ago, and I separated and came down here and thought of money first, mammon first, profitability first over spiritual realities. And I'm just going to have to walk away from it. I'm going to have to do like it says in Luke 17 and turn my back and go away. He didn't do that. He stays. And so what happens? As we go further down, it says, verse 9. Here's their retort to that. They said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, now notice how they're going to argue for this. These are the Sodomites, the homosexuals in Sodom. This one came in as an alien. He's not really one of us. This is what they're saying. And already he is acting like a judge. These people already knew Matthew 7:1. Judge not lest you be judged. Don't you hear that a lot from non-Christians all the time? How dare you come in here with your truth trying to tell me that I'm this and I'm that or whatever. You come in here with your heterosexual lifestyles and telling us that you're just a homophobe. You're judging us. Quit judging us. They were practicing this in Genesis 19. Guy comes in as an alien here and acting like he knows better than us. He knows. He has a higher sense of morality. Going to tell us how we should live and who we can marry and who we can't marry. Didn't he read the decision of Obergefell and all of that? Marriage among homosexuals is the same as marriage among heterosexuals. He comes in and acting like a judge. Now let me tell you what we're going to do to you. We're going to treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. And the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. You would tend to think they would have wearied themselves trying to find their way home. You get blinded by the judgment of God. I think you want to go home. Not these people. They're driven by their libido. Libido's king here. And we got to get that thing settled here. We got to find those men. Where's that door? Blind as a bat trying to find the door. Then the men said to Lot, whom else have you here? These are the two angels. A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters and whoever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters. So these were potential suitors coming in and they were going to be marrying his daughter. So got a heterosexual relationship here going. Now, undoubtedly, he could leave. Or maybe he could get out the house or whatever. But he goes to the son-in-laws. Look, you got to leave. This isn't like Rahab, who happened to hear that the Israelites were, you know, entering the land and wanted to be a part and parcel of this new group. These are people, these are angels telling them, if you got anybody else, you need to go get them. And you need to bring them with you outside the city. So he goes to these son-in-laws. And he says, verse 14, up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. Here's Lot. Here's a street evangelist. Here's a street preacher. His first audience is going to be his son-in-laws. But he appeared to his son-in-laws to be joking. Comedy of it. Now, which tells me something about your witness. If this is the first time you're talking to people who are going to be a part of your household about the judgment of God and about spiritual conditions and spiritual principles, and they think you're a joke. What does that tell me about how Lot's relationship with his potential son-in-laws up to that point was? Wasn't taken very seriously. This guy's suffering from a very, very testimonial problem. He lives in Sodom. He lives among the Sodomites. He's got two daughters who are going to marry two men who are going to be his sons-in-laws that we're going to find out who perish. Who don't listen to their father-in-law. Here's their make or break moment. They get the only evangelist who's ever going to come to anybody who's in the land of Sodom, these two men, and they think he's joking. They didn't even say something. Well, wait, let me go kiss my mom goodbye or something like this, and they perish. They think he's joking. Are you kidding me? Seriously? You're telling me this? Verse 15. And when morning dawned, the angel urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. These two son-in-laws had the opportunity to get there, but now it's time. We can't wait for them. But then, verse 16, so he jumps up and gets on his horse, but he hesitated. And he got Lot still hesitating, dragging his feet in Sodom. I mean, he could have used Lot as an example in Luke 17. But remember Lot, and not just Lot's wife. But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand, and here's the catch you want to catch, and the hand of his wife. You're being taken by the hand of an angel. In the hands of his daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. And it came about when they had brought them outside that one said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you. There's that word of angels that proved unalterable in Hebrews 2:2. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains lest you be swept away. But Lot said to them, oh no, my lords. really. He's getting pushback again. He hesitates in the house. Now he's hesitating when they put him outside the city. He's got angels got him by the hands and bringing him outside the city. And he's still hesitating and pushing back. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Oh, like Tara's lost. I can't do anything. I'm paralyzed. I'm crying my beer right here. Oh my goodness, what am I going to do with this guy? He's like a boat anchor. Take him by the hand. I knew they're going to do this. And so he says, verse 20. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small? Small in Hebrew is the same word as Zor. Zor and small is the same. That my life may be saved. That's how he thinks it's going to be saved. I got to go to another town. And he said to him, behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town. Zor was supposed to be overthrown, of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the town was called Zor. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zor. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. Now, that should be the end of the story, but we got one more verse on it. But his wife, from behind him, should have been on the side of him, looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, the very next verse, we see somebody else looking at Sodom, and he didn't become a pillar of salt. Who's that guy? Now, Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham. See, the prayer of Abraham, chapter 18. And sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. And Lot went up from Zor. Now he goes to Zor. Calamity's over. And stayed in the mountains. Finally gets to the mountains. He gets out of Zor. And his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zor. This guy lived by fear. And he stayed in the cave, he and his two daughters. Now, if that was enough, that could have been the story and could have had a happy, kind of happy ending. But we're told in 31 through 38, then the firstborn said to the younger, our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. In other words, to have children. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, and that we may preserve our family through our father. So they made their father drink wine that night. The firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. How do you make a guy drunk? He doesn't know when he rises, when he lays down. Verse 31. It came about on the morrow that the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let's make him drunk with wine again. He goes in so that we can preserve our family through our father. And so the whole reason for saying this is the origination of the Moabites in verse 37 from the firstborn and the Ammonites from the secondborn. This is Lot. This is the environment Lot's wife was in. A man who could take his daughters and give them to the Sodomites just so he can protect the strangers inside of his house. Gets drunk and lays with someone, with a woman. Has no clue. It's like, did you do this often? I mean, is this an acquired habit? How did you learn to do this? And this isn't like, you know, it doesn't sound like it was the first time for him kind of thing. But we don't know. But you look at this kind of behavior on the part of Lot, and then we get back to Lot's wife. Now, if Lot's wife was really from Sodom, that turn, and this is the two things you want to take away from this message here, remembering Lot's wife. The contextual message in Luke 17 is when you flee and you put your hands to the plow, you don't look back. You're a Christian. You're walking with Christ. You don't look back. You look back, remember Lot's wife. And if you drill a little deeper, this is what you want to remember about Lot's wife that makes it so unbelievable that she would look back. First of all, look at the privilege she had. Think of that privilege she had. And the privilege you have is no guarantee of your spiritual status. She had an uncle-in-law who had the promises of God. She had a husband who was righteous. She lived every day with this man, I'm sure, talking about the torment of the soul. They are having to judge in the gates about how wicked these things were. She heard that. She was privy to that. She had two daughters, undoubtedly, her influence with the two daughters, for them to do the things they did with their dad so they could preserve their family. Preserve their family. This is the big principle for them. We've got to preserve our family. We've got to have offspring. Whatever we do, give me children lest I die, and I don't care how I get them. It's like, yeah, we do care how we get them. Abraham was very picky on how he got a wife for Isaac. You think he might have learned something a little bit there with maybe Lot and how he got his wife? I don't know. I mean, the spiritual privileges are unbelievable. Right there in front of her. She had angels come to the house they prepared food for. I'm sure Lot recognized these men, and they're telling them, not just him, she's in hearing distance of this. We're going to destroy the city tonight. You need to arise and leave. Go get any kind of other people you have in your family, kind of like Rahab. She brings her whole family and saves her family inside of her house. Nobody comes into Lot's house. That's the kind of influence Lot had on his wife. Zero. When it came to spiritual matters. So I'm just going to kind of give you the underpinnings here. This privilege this woman had, and it went in one ear and out the other, and it never profited her. Because when the time of real decision-making came, all you have to do to save your life is to keep your face right here. I'm just going to put a harness on that you can't turn your head. And I'm afraid I might turn my head. Lot, once you get right next to me, or let me get in front of you, so if I go to turn, you'll push my head back to him. And that turn to look back to Sodom was a little bit more than just simply a small disobedience. That head turn revealed a heart. Her heart was still in Sodom. And I don't think she was turned to say, did I leave the porch light on? Let me look. That wasn't it. That's where my heart is. Now, how do I know that? Matthew 6 talks about, talking about storing up treasures. Remember he said that in Matthew 6? Storm in heaven, don't storm down here on earth. And then he talks about, right there in the context, let me tell you how a man gets a treasure. Because he says, where your heart is, that's where your treasure. Your treasure is going to identify your heart. And your heart's going to identify your treasures. There is no such thing in the world as a treasure without a heart. We say one man's trash is another man's treasure. Let me tell you what makes the difference between trash and treasure. A heart. That's why Jesus drills a little deeper and says, the eye is the lamp of the body. The eye is that judge in you, that discerner in you that says, treasure, trash. Treasure, trash. And he says, if your eye is full of light that can discern true treasure, you will be perfectly aligned. But if you're calling light dark, or darkness, you're calling that darkness, you're calling that light, says your whole body is going to be full of darkness. Basically, he who is faithful in the little is going to be faithful in much. Who is unfaithful in the little is going to be unfaithful in much. And those are Jesus' words. Why is that those two things together? Because it all goes back to the eye. And then the next paragraph says that's why you can't serve God and mammon. Because see, when you try to serve mammon, that's darkness in you. Your eye has called mammon something else instead of what it really needs to be called. And you'll go down that path toward destruction. And you won't store treasures in heaven. You'll store them down here on earth. This is what Lot did. And he had a wife who did the same thing. And her treasure was being destroyed behind her. And so since that's where her heart was, that's where her eyes were eventually going to be. She used those eyes 24/7 all of her life to say treasure, treasure, treasure. And now Lot says, we got to go this way. Treasure's going to be over here. And she could not turn back. It was like a reflex. That's where treasure is. And she paid a costly price for it. What she had versus what she loved. She had all these privileges. She was in Zor's gates. People could be that close to salvation and lose it. And turn their head. And I got to go to see what happened to my treasure. It wasn't as if they just walked outside the door of the house and the fires were right behind them. They were right there in Zoar in Genesis 19, and she turns. Now, how did Lot know she did that? He'd have to turn back and look at his wife to find that out. If he would have turned back, he'd have became a pillar of salt too. He couldn't turn back. I got to go forward. The angel said, don't look back. You still back there, honey? Not hearing anything. You with us? Not hearing anything. There's two daughters. Keep going. Just keep going. Don't turn back and don't look for mom. You'll be looking at Sodom. You've got to keep going forward, forward, forward. Until finally they realize. Mom's not with us. How come mom didn't make it? And they go back, or they look, obviously afterwards, and she has this contortion, body facing one way, but heart and eyes facing a different way. And she'll always be a monument to those who have their hands on the plow and look back. To those, like it says in 2 Peter 2, who know the way of righteousness. They know what it means to be a Christian. They know what it means to become a Christian and what it means to follow Christ. They know. They heard the word as an altar. Their heart, or something in their fears, or something in their loves that keeps driving them back. Remember, Lot's the guy who's full of fear. Lot's wife is the woman who's full of love. Lot didn't have a love for self, but he had just this inordinate, irrational fear. Oh, I can't move. I can't do this. Like, really? You know, I can't even go. You know, it's like, look, if we waited this long, we're going to wait for you. I can't do nothing until you get to Zoar. I mean, that right there should have helped. But this is the kind of environment that my wife grew up. This kind of privilege, and that privilege did not equate to spiritual status. And it didn't operate. You make a transfer. I'll be set to 55. There we go. Sorry. We can make the transfer of our own situation and the spiritual privileges we've been given. And you have. As it says in Hebrews 6, you've tasted of the word of God, partaken of the Holy Spirit, yada, yada. All these things that you have in the Christian community, and you walk out, and really your heart and your eyes are in Sodom. So that's what Jesus says. You want to find out where a guy's heart is? You want to find out if a guy really loves Christ, he really loves the world? Yeah, I would really like to find that out. I'd like to find that out by myself. Okay. Just listen to yourself for a while. Listen to somebody else talk for a while. Oh, they're talking about Sodom an awful lot. They're talking about the news of Sodom, the political this and the financial that parts of the papers of Sodom and Gomorrah, and what's going on in the valley, and how many people are buying sheep, and how many stocks of cattle can I get now, and what's the best land to buy, and can I get this for, you know, a dollar to a dime, and that kind of thing. Ah, that's the news for Sodom. And that's the talk of the land. Never talking about their soul, never talking about eternity, never talking about judgment. Especially when you got two angels coming down saying, time's up, I'm here to take you out. You would tend to think at that moment, whatever grabs your heart and would probably want to grab your heart the most wouldn't be your possessions, it'd be your people. The lives of your wife, your kids, and they gather them up. And then you see at the very end how his daughter live and how they think. They're not even thinking along the lines of, let's find God. Let's go back to Abraham. Let's find Abraham and kind of hitch our wagons with him. I mean, none of this is happening to him. And if God's hearing his prayer, I definitely want to be around that guy. And that's what you would think. That's not what takes place, is it? But yet here's righteous Lot. And the only signal righteousness we have of him is that his soul was tormented day and night because of the conduct of unprincipled men in 2 Peter 2. So here on this Mother's Day, it's kind of bring this thing to a head, right? We want to remember our moms and our grandmothers, Lois and Eunice, it says in 2 Timothy chapter 3, who helped Timothy to find the truth and to find the way of salvation. That's the kind of moms are honored. But every now and then, you'll get a mom in here. You need to take a look at it and say, don't be that mother. Don't be that woman whose heart is in Sodom. And Sodom finally catches up with her, this big monument to what it looks like to have a heart that's set on Sodom. And there she is, a pillar of salt. this woman, that what she had versus what she loved, what she did and what she became. All these things, it's like, wow, love with the world, the love of the Father is not in them. The love of the Father wasn't in her. And so for us as Christians, application is pretty simple, right? But going back to Luke, the application he uses with the lost wife, he didn't go into all the details we're going into. He says, remember the lost wife, when you put your hand to the plow and you go forward, you go forward. Well, let her stand as, I can't look back. I'm a Christian. I'm going to go forward and let the chips fall as they may. And here's all these, the herdsmen, the cattle, the land, Lot separated from Abraham so that he could take. And at the end of the day, it's him and his two wayward daughters living in a cave. That's what happens when you follow the Lord. Eventually, you lose it all. And you should. Because the world's, this isn't our home. We're like Abraham. We live in a tent. But you know, it's a whole lot easier if I can just settle down. I don't have to sojourn. I can find something a whole lot more stable. I'm in a city with walls. I can feel protected. I got insurance. I got guns. I mean, I got a life of ease. But do I really want to go live in a tent? A tent? Walk around in the backwoods of Chicago, what it sounds like over there. I mean, you talk about become prey. There's a whole lot more protection for Abraham in a tent. Sojourning in heaven than it is for Sodom living a life of ease over here in Sodom and Gomorrah in the city of the plains. Over here in Canaan, sojourning with tents. There's more hedge of protection for him than it would be for Lot. He lost it all. And this idea of Lot's wife, once again, for us, is that we want to remember her as a negative example. The Lord, I do not want to turn back. You're a Christian. You've been baptized. You go forward. There's no turning back. There's no regrets. There's no, well, geez, if I'd have known this, I don't know if I would have become a Christian. You've got that? Welcome to Lot's wife. You are part of her posterity. And yet, you will be turned into a pillar of salt on Judgment Day as a result. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this time. We thank you for this reminder of this woman. We might not be facing the destruction of Jerusalem historically in Luke 17. Father, we are always mindful, Father, that our life is a vapor, that any day or any moment we can be taken up to glory, that we could be shedding this body that you have given us. So Father, always give us a sense of urgency and give us a sense of focus toward the heavenly city. And we're not going to turn back. We can't turn back. We must go forward. We must go straight ahead. And even if others turn, we're not going to turn to save them, because we lose our souls in the process. And when it comes to walking with you, it's a solo endeavor. It's something that we have to pursue with you and you alone. What is the treasure of our heart? Take all the Sodom and Gomorrah trinkets out of our hearts. Cause us, Father, to see what they really amount to. Is that this world is passing away. Keep us from being like those people in the book of Revelation who weep and wail because of the destruction of Babylon, the things they made for commerce and made for money. We love you and we thank you. It's in Christ's great name we pray. Amen.